This is Mormon Stories. I'm John DeLynn. Let me begin, maybe, Mary, by having you tell us a bit about your early years in the church, your heritage, your, whatever is formative in your LDS upbringing that you think would help inform this narrative that we're going to tell tonight.
Okay. I don't know how many generation Mormon on both sides of my family. They're pioneers on every side of my family. And I was raised in Salt Lake City in the stake that actually its boundaries encompass Temple Square. And so the church is like in my soul. It's in my body. It was all around me growing up. I was the oldest of six kids, and I was the only girl. And I was the oldest. I said that. Ever since I can remember, I wanted to go on a mission. Both of my parents are missionaries. The church was the center of my life for as long as I can remember. When I got to seminary, I loved seminary. I was on seminary council and my life just centered around seminary and the church. And maybe to kind of sum up where I was, on New Year's Eve, it fell on a Sunday, and my friends and I, we had a testimony meeting on New Year's Eve. That's how much the church was the center of my being. And for me, the central teaching was the two great commandments, to love God and to love your neighbor. And for me, the whole purpose of my life was to try to see everybody as a child of God. And for me, that was what resonated about the church. Being the only girl in my family, I think the side of the church that was difficult for me growing up was that there was all the emphasis on Boy Scouts and the young men. And if there was something that I had trouble with in the church, it was that I felt like there was so much attention paid to my brothers and not very many programs for me. I went to BYU, went on a mission, married Peter in the temple. Served in Relief Society presidency, primary presidency, served in the Young Women's, kind of did it all.
Where did you serve your mission?
New York South Mission. It took in Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island, Staten Island. It was right in the inner city, mostly, in the hood.
And any fond memories of your mission experience?
I loved my mission. I still have lots of really great memories of my mission. It was an incredible experience to go from growing up in Salt Lake to all of a sudden living in the inner city of New York, and this incredible cultural diversity, meeting people from every continent, people who had grown up in extreme poverty, all kinds of things I'd never seen. It opened my eyes to a whole big world that I didn't know existed.
New York City.
Yeah, it was a great place. Mm.
How was BYU?
BYU, well, I always wanted to go to BYU. That was always my goal. And if anyone asked me when I was at BYU, I always said, oh, it's so great. I love it there. And there were things that I loved. But if I look at my journal and my memories, I got really, really depressed at BYU. And I really kind of shut down in a lot of ways because I was always so worried that I wouldn't do something right, that I wouldn't be righteous enough, I wouldn't do anything right. That I became very shy mostly and kind of lost my outgoing personality in a lot of ways. With my roommates, I was outgoing. But I remember in the music program, I felt pretty shy and pretty nervous because I was always afraid I would do the wrong thing or that I wouldn't be righteous. And came home from my mission and hated BYU. I had a semester left and I thought, these people are worried about parking. They're worried about shorts to their knees. And I'm thinking, I've just been to a city where I've seen drug abuse and where people get shot every night on the corners that I walk on. And I just thought, this isn't reality. And that was when I first actually could acknowledge that BYU wasn't a very good fit for me. It was actually coming home from my mission. I didn't like it.
Well, as I recall, the music program at BYU is pretty demanding.
Yeah, it is. A very good program.
Did you play in the concert choir, the concert orchestras?
I did. I played in the Philharmonic. In my senior year, I had the opportunity to be one of the concert masters. And I also played in the Chamber Orchestra, which was the orchestra that would get to go on tours different places. So, which was a really good experience.
Must have been wonderful.
Yeah.
And your parents, have they always been true believers, strong in the gospel?
Oh, absolutely. They both went on missions, married in the temple, both graduated from BYU.
To this day?
To this day, very active, although very supportive of me. So it's been a conflict for them.
Well, I assume you felt like you had a testimony of the church when you were growing up.
Oh, yeah.
What was that rooted in?
It was really rooted in, like I said a little bit ago, the two great commandments. The stories of Jesus and the Gospels really resonated with me about this man who loved us all so much and that had compassion on people, like the story of the woman at the well and the story of the Good Samaritan. All those kinds of things were really what was at the core for me. In high school, that's when I think I really gained my testimony. I believed in it before, but when I went to seminary, I just really got excited about the church. And I remember that really my moment of spiritual awakening was just kind of feeling like I had this revelation that we were really children of God and that we were all really important. And for me, that was what the church was about, what the gospel was about.
Do you remember strong spiritual experiences and stuff that sort of you look back as pillars of that testimony or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember one time, on my mission, we were trying to figure out what we should do. It was close to Christmas. It wasn't a very good time to go tracting. It was freezing cold, so it wasn't a very good time to street contact. And we decided we'd go Christmas caroling. And I remember we decided to say a prayer that we'd know where we should go. And I had the opportunity to be the voice for that prayer. And as I was praying, it was almost like a vision. I could imagine that there was this person, and it was a woman, and she was in extreme pain emotionally, and we needed to find her. And then I told the other sisters about this, and then we went out and went to this apartment building, felt like that was where we should go, and knocked on a couple doors, and then knocked on this lady's door, and she answered it, and we were singing Christmas Carol, and she just started to sob and said, "Come in." And we went in and she said, "You don't know how much I needed you to come right now." She and her boyfriend had been getting into an argument. And when we came back later, she told us that those arguments often ended in violence and that we had saved her a beating. And so, I mean, that was a powerful experience to me where I felt like God had let me know that we had something important to accomplish.
So through your marriage and even beyond, would you say the church was everything or almost everything along with family?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, everything came down to the gospel in my mind. I mean, my family, I love my family, but the only way to have my family forever was through the gospel. So the church always took the front seat to anything, not because I didn't love my husband or love my children, but in my mind, the only way to really love them was to love the church and to love the gospel, because if I let go of that, I'd lose them. So
that makes sense. So Peter, let's turn to you for a bit, and why don't you kind of give us the same type of perspective with your history?
Well, I think I had a somewhat more conflicted past with the church maybe than Mary, although equally devout. My mother came from pioneer ancestry, And my dad was a convert to the church as a teenager from Judaism. And his parents had both died, and he joined the church right before his father died at 15, I think. And
where?
He grew up in Manhattan. And it's a really intriguing story, I think, especially for Mormons, I think. It's very different if you hear it as a Jew or as a Mormon. He and his sister, their mother had died a few years before. Their father was dying of cancer. And his sister, who had obsessive compulsive disorder, had in her mind that he was going to become a serial killer if she didn't get him religion. And so off they traipsed to the synagogue, and it turned out to be the High Holy Days. And so they needed tickets to get in that day, and they didn't have tickets because their parents had been semi-agnostic and hadn't really gone to synagogue very much. So they got turned away, and she was furious. And it just so happened that they lived next door to the Manhattan ward of the LDS Church. And so the next Sunday, she marched him over there, and they walked in and announced they were looking for God. And of course, got a very warm welcome. And right before my grandfather died, they decided they wanted to get baptized. And I think he felt like they had some Mormon friends, and he felt like they would probably take good care of his kids if his family fell through. There was a lot of mental illness in the family, and so I'm sure he was worried about them. And indeed, not too long after he died, they found homes for both of them to live in Utah. My dad moved to Spring City to finish high school.
Springville.
Yeah, Spring City's wrong spot. Moved to Springville, which he said was incredible culture shock.
From New York.
He used to get up at in the middle of the night and ride to the truck stop so he could know people were still awake in the world. Anyway, he went to BYU and met my mom there. They married. My dad sang in the Tabernacle Choir off and on
really?
For a long, long time. I think it was 15 years total, but, you know, it was kind of when he wasn't too busy with other things. And so when I was young, he was head of maintenance at the church's the records vault in Little Cottonwood Canyon. And my mom later on was manager of Mormon Handicraft. So Mary and I actually grew up, she didn't mention this, but we grew up in the same ward. And so same ward she talked about, right in the center of things, really close to downtown, a lot of general authorities around.
In your ward?
I'm trying to think.
Not usually.
They usually lived in like the Eagle Gate apartments or somewhere down right close. So they were in the stake, but we got lots of visitors.
When the prophet was in our stake.
Yeah. And his daughter's family lived in our ward for a while.
President Benson.
Yeah. So grew up right in the thick of things. But I think I had a little bit of – I didn't really realize this until I got a lot older and started studying dual cultures. I realized I had grown up with two cultures. One was – I think what anyone in Utah would probably recognize as Mormon culture. And then the second was through my father, very devout LDS, but a very Jewish thinker, questioning things. And he always wanted to delve into all these intriguing mysteries and ask questions and play the devil's advocate and argue. And one of his favorite sayings was, where there are two Jews, there are three opinions. So that's what I grew up with. When I was seven, my dad went through a period of really a terrible experience of abuse working for the church. Some documents turned up at, I'm trying to remember what book, Sam Weller's. And they had, an agreement to any sensitive materials they would let the church know. And they immediately just kind of without cause decided my father must have done it because he was the one smart enough to get in. Not a lot of people had a combination, and he was had access to all the areas. And it was proved pretty quickly that it couldn't have been him because it didn't even come from the vault. They could tell from the microfilm that they had recovered that it was like five generations down from the vault copy. But somebody obviously panicked.
Do you know what the documents
were? I think it was John Taylor's journal or something like that. You know, I'd have to go look in my dad's journal to double check. I'm not even sure he knew. They came in one day. They cordoned off his office. They said, go home. Don't tell anybody why you're going home. Don't tell anybody what's going on, including your wife and your bishop. And then they wouldn't let him back in his office to collect any of his private belongings.
Was he fired?
No. Don't say anything to anyone or you'll be immediately terminated and excommunicated. And unfortunately, they weren't, maybe it's hard to keep quiet when you send someone home like that, but everybody knew something was going on. Rumors were all around that my dad was maybe an apostate and going to be excommunicated. And my mom, of course, was frantic because here he comes home from work and can't even explain why he's home. And eventually he did tell her, and he eventually went to the bishop for help. But they actually investigated him for 7 months, I think, before they let him go back to work and had replaced him already at work.
So he got paid to not work for 7 months.
That is true. That's the only bright side.
he was suffering. He wasn't partying.
I think it was a really devastating experience to my family, and he got interviewed frequently. I read his journal, and at one point he had written down that they found he kept a lot of private papers at work in his files and whatnot, and he had written a paper on the second anointing, and they wanted to know who this BYU professor was he had talked to that didn't want his name quoted in the paper, and they sat him down and told him his eternal salvation hinged on him answering these questions truthfully, and then kind of wrung the name out of him. And he was told repeatedly that the Quorum of the Twelve had authorized this and that he was to comply fully. And so it was a really horrible experience for him because he hadn't done anything, so he couldn't figure out how to get out of trouble. And finally, his bishop began advocating for him a little bit, and they got a hearing in front of Elder Tanner, I think, who...
And Eldon Tanner?
Yes. And who was the 70?
Royden Derrick,
I think, Elder Royden Derrick, who was head of the genealogical department at the time. And Elder Derrick said, we're sorry. Obviously, we've been really horrible to you. What do you want us to do? Do you want us to apologize? Or my dad had the whole time had been very loyal. He said, I would never want you to tell anybody what you did because it's embarrassing for the church. I wouldn't want anyone to know how you treated me. And so he said, do you want your job back? And Dad's a nice guy. He said, you've had somebody else working my job for 7 months. How am I supposed to tell him, fire him? So he said, find me a job with equal pay. Discontinued that job 8 months later. And when he tried to transfer, security wouldn't clear him, even though he had the combination to the vault previously. They wouldn't clear him for any jobs. And so he ended up not working for the church anymore, which is devastating to him because his life's dream was to work for God.
How many years did he work for the church then?
You know, I think he worked there... I'm not sure, 7 years, something like that. So this all happened when I was 7.
Right.
Moving into 8. I remember that there was a lot of tension at home. Mom was really depressed, and the whole family was a little terrorized. Dad was telling us, well, I don't know if he told us then or later, but that his phone had been tapped. And the conversations he'd had with people had been recorded because they brought this stuff up in interviews with him that was where it had to have come from. So he was really paranoid about what had happened and about being watched. And so it was a really tough time. And then it was time for me to get baptized. and I do remember kind of having this tension around that, about not really feeling ready to get baptized, not really feeling safe. And Dad always used to joke with me that I was, at the time that I was 8 going on 40. He thought I was thinking way too much. But I do remember the baptismal interview, and I remember him asking me a question like, do you believe in the atonement of Christ, and can you tell me about that? And I remember thinking, well, I know the answer is yes, but that's a complex subject, and I have no idea where to even begin. You know, I was a kid, and I thought, I sort of get it, but it's really complex, and I don't think I really understand it. I thought that in my head, but I knew you were supposed to say yes, so I said yes. And, so there was all this conflict as well, but Dad managed to resolve it. Mom really never talked about it, and Dad felt like whatever horrible things happened, that God was still in charge and there was some grand design and that he was suffering for a cause.
So he maintained his faith in the church.
Absolutely. He was under no illusions that what had happened was in any way kind or correct, or, but he did feel like somehow God had allowed it to happen for a greater purpose, that his suffering was for some divine purpose. And so that's kind of how he dealt with it. And he always held that hope of going back to work for the church, which, despite applying for lots of jobs, never happened.
Is he still alive?
Huh?
Yeah. He still is.
Still alive and still faithful.
Still faithful to the church.
Yeah. So all that was going on, but after
did
a few years.
Did it register with you, like in your junior high, high school years? Were you thinking the church did my dad wrong, or?
You know how Dad spun it to us was that church security was evil. Church security was, there were evil people that worked for the church that thought they were protecting God and went around hurting people. That's how he spun it to us.
So did that deflect it for you to the security?
When we played for the orchestra, Mary's always like, why do you hate these security guys so much? I was like, because they're bad people. No offense, man, to anyone out there. But that, I really felt like, you know, these are people that did my family bad. It repeatedly came up because his next job after working for the church, he worked for Honeywell. And he got called down to work on the system down at the church office building in the same room that the First Presidency's vault was. And the first day he was on the job, he went back second day and they said, what did you do to tick those people off? He said, what do you mean? He said, we got a call from them. And they said, if you ever send that person down here again, we will cancel our contract with you.
Hmm.
So it was pretty, every time he tried to solve the problem, it seemed like it just got worse. When I was a teenager, he had talked to a friend who knew several gender authorities and was a lawyer. And this friend said, let's resolve this. These are nice people. We can. So he helped him. Dad wrote out his experience. His friend helped him kind of parse it down to a 2 or 3 page letter and then hand delivered it to,
Elder Faust,
I think. And both of them were stunned when they got a letter back that said, if you want to sue the church, go ahead, but we will take you down, pretty much. I'm paraphrasing. They were both stunned at this response, that because he didn't want to sue the church. What he wanted to say was, something really bad happened to me, and I'd really like to resolve it so that every time I apply for a job, I don't get turned away or the job criteria gets changed so that I don't qualify anymore. Or
right, just have a status change. What was your church experience? What did the church mean to you growing up, especially as a teen?
Well, I grew up with, I had a really bad anxiety disorder, which left me probably a little on the obsessive compulsive side. And so I had kind of a perpetual sense that I was not living up to what I should be. And the church was really central in my family. Dad, it was what we talked about all the time. And because Dad was so Jewish, we'd have these wild, that's what Sundays were for wild gospel conversations. And what do you think about this? And, oh, let's think about this doctrine here. And how does this intersect with that? And, I do remember being really bored at church because of that, because I would go to class and I'd be just bored stiff. We heard this story last year and the year before, and I already know it, and I want to, let's hear a new story, or let's go deeper. So I do remember that. But I was just a pretty normal Mormon kid, you know, nervous one. Tried to be devout, always worried about that I didn't have a strong enough testimony, and it was because I wasn't a good enough person.
Did you ever have positive spiritual experiences in the church, or uplifting?
I would say so. What I remember best in terms of positive was when I went on my mission, and I thought, you know, it all makes sense to me. I understood the church thoroughly. Ironically, we got an anti-Mormon book that talked about the difference between believing something and the difference between knowing it. And I read that and I thought, you know, I believe the church, but I don't really know it's true. And that really struck me. And I felt like I had to have this spiritual conversion instead of just an intellectual understanding of how everything worked and believing it. So when I went on my mission, I was determined that before I got out of the MTC, I was going to have that experience, or I was not going to go to Germany, because there was no way I just felt like I have to have that, or I can't go out there and be honest about preaching this to people if I don't have that fire in my own heart that says this is it. So I was fervently reading the Book of Mormon in the MTC, so that I had this idea, I'll read it all the way through, I'll do Moroni's promise, but I'll have done it all together. And on my mission, I had just wonderful spiritual experiences all the time. Really, in some ways, kind of similar to Mary, but I came out of the MTC with conviction and, you know, had, I guess, your typical kind of, I had a real feeling that because this was the truth, there would be a way to share it with everybody, and that my responsibility as a missionary was to be in tune enough with the Spirit that I would understand the way to present it to them, that they could accept it. And so I was always very much, even at that point, kind of a universalist, Unitarian sort of mindset that everybody is a child of God, so everybody must be great. And the problem we have is that we haven't learned how to be compassionate enough and kind enough to each other so that people can accept it. So I had lots of marvelous experiences just really connecting with people in a way that I hadn't before. Finding people that just kind of what Mary was talking about, that I would know somebody was out there that needed us and we'd run into them. And I had a really marvelous experience. One day I was really discouraged. I was with a companion that didn't want to work very much. And I didn't want to work either. It was 6 o'clock and I thought, we're going to go home and we're not going to come back out because neither of us wants to work. And so I was on the bus praying, for something to happen so that I'd want to work. And I looked up, and as I looked at each person, I would have a vision. I could see where they were at in life. And then it was like I could see sort of as an aura around them, what their potential might be if they could reach their full potential. And I got really excited because I thought, I'm here to help these people reach their full potential, and forced my companion to go do tracking until 9:30 that night or something. He was not pleased with my spiritual experience. So I came back from my mission probably uber devout. And my goal in life was to be a seminary teacher because I felt like I had a calling to share the way I understood the gospel with people. And I felt like I think I'm a pretty okay teacher, so it fit well. So I did a music major in composition, which I was under no illusions. I was never going to earn any money. So my career path was I was going to be a seminary teacher. So I took institute and I think I took more than you needed to grad, twice as much as you needed to graduate probably. So I don't know. I've rambled on a long time.
No, it's good. So did either of you experience any type of intellectual or cultural crisis of faith before your marriage, where you considered leaving the church or had these debilitating doubts about its truthfulness or anything like that?
The closest I ever came was as a teenager, probably, 17, 18. Not too long before my mission. And I remember looking at, I was worried about not having a strong enough testimony. And I remember thinking several times, if this weren't true, it just has all the hallmarks of a fraud. But it's true, so I've just got to study harder. That was kind of how I thought about it.
So you made it through.
Yeah, well, it never occurred to me, like, to even really question it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there were things I had trouble with. Like, my mom's a very strong personality. She taught me to never just listen to a man. So I had some trouble with the patriarchy, but it didn't mean it wasn't true in my mind.
Right. So you got married. What happened between then and your decision to write that letter?
Well, I didn't become a seminary teacher. And it's not for lack of trying either. No, I really desperately wanted to be a seminary teacher, and I was terribly disappointed because that wasn't too long after we got married that I was doing that.
Yeah.
I did my student teaching. It wasn't a very good experience because the teacher they put me with was just completely burned out. It was the very end of the school year, and I was supposed to teach a class of students who all year had been allowed to come in and do their homework during seminary. So I had this horrible problem of trying to be an engaging enough teacher that kids who hadn't had to pay attention for a whole year would suddenly want to get their scriptures out, and actually follow along. Coupled with the fact that like 2/3 of how they evaluated you was how the students liked you. But they would come watch you teach. So it was just a really no-win situation. They offered me, a part-time job the next year, and then at the last minute pulled it and really didn't say why. They said, we've reshuffled and we don't have enough spots. In the back of my mind, I had tried to get I worked for the church for a while as a teenager on their temporary pool, and then again when I came back from my mission. And at one point, I'd been offered a job up at the vault, which I loved because I'd gone up there a lot when my dad worked there. And I thought, well, that would be nice. It was going to last, I don't know, 8 months to a year, I think they told me. And so I applied. They said it was all set up. I just had to clear the security check and come back Monday, and they'd tell me when to show up to work. And I came back Monday, and they said, oh, we don't need that position anymore. And this kind of thing had happened to my dad a lot, and I have the same name. And I realized that, oh, you know, maybe there's something there. And I think in the back of my mind, when the seminary thing happened like that, it probably had nothing to do with it. But there was a little part of me from growing up that I thought, this is never going to happen. And I really felt like I'd been led by God's will to this path. And I had put more into it because for somebody with a serious anxiety disorder to decide I want to teach teenagers. this was crazy. You know, it had taken everything I had to work on it. I remember spending 5 hours a night preparing my lessons, and I had kind of, it was really devastating. And he was nice. He said, you know, you can come back next year and try again. And I thought about it for a long time, but in the back of my mind, there was always that nagging thing. Like it was the first time I'd ever realized that I might know I'm following God's will and put everything into it, and this might stop me. And I didn't think I could bear to do that all over again, especially if there was any chance that I wasn't going to get this job because of my name. That was kind of in the back. I didn't really even think it out loud or talk about it much, but there was that fear. So that's why I didn't become a seminary teacher. I've forgotten where we were going after that.
So how you ended up writing a letter, what led up to that?
Oh, well, so Well, we were just a happy little Mormon couple anyway. We were getting by. We were musicians. And when the orchestra Temple Square started,
how'd that happen?
Mary was a shoo-in because she was an incredible violin player. And she was excited. And maybe you should tell about why you were excited about that. But
I was really excited because...
was there some announcement, like, we're going to start this thing?
Well, I actually was the Barlow Bradford, who was the first director of the orchestra at Temple Square. I was his graduate assistant up at the U. And so he actually told me one day about the time, I think it was right before they made the announcement that they were going to form this orchestra and wanted, you know, hoped I was interested in being in it. So I was thrilled because I was just finishing graduate school. And then the way I was raised, my job now was to become a mom. And
it did. I told her, you are the one who can have a career. Your teacher wants you to apply for the symphony. And she wouldn't do it, darn it.
Well, I love music. And my dream was always to be a professional musician. But I always felt like I could only do that if I could accomplish it before my kids were born. And once my kids were born, then I couldn't do it anymore until they were raised. And then maybe I could do it again because I felt like I would be a bad mom and I would put my family's eternal salvation in jeopardy. So when Barlow told me that the orchestra was for me, I was thrilled because it meant I could play in something that was really high caliber and I wouldn't be a bad person for being away from my kids. Because it just wasn't, in my mind, it wasn't even an option to have a job. And so.
Is that a paid job?
No.
Volunteers. No,
it's a church calling.
It's a calling.
It's a calling. It's a missionary calling from the first presidency.
So you're called as a musical missionary and actually set apart. And actually, there was a lot of debate initially about pay because Barlow Bradford he talked to them consistently about, you want professional caliber people and this isn't the same as singers. You're asking these people to come during their work hours at night when they have gigs or students, and you need to find some way to make it so they can afford to play in it or we can't get this caliber of people. So initially they were going to hire the orchestra members for any paid recordings that they did, anything that the church was paying musicians for. They were supposed to hire the orchestra, but there was, I think, from the top kind of an agenda that it wasn't sacred unless it was free. Unless it was all volunteer labor. So they discontinued that pretty couple years in, I think.
Yeah.
So were you guys members from the start?
We were.
Yeah, Mary talked me into auditioning like at the last minute. Like the very, I hadn't decided to do it until the very cutoff date. And then I thought, why not? It'd be cool to play in it together.
Now, Mary, you played the violin, right?
Yeah.
What did you play, Peter?
I play viola.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Was it tough to get in? Were you good enough or?
I was good enough.
you made it.
No,
it was pretty competitive. I know a lot of people who tried out that didn't make it.
It actually was competitive, right? I think it got less competitive later on. Well, yeah. But I was a pretty good violist. I was a composition major, but I had done, it took me 6 years. And part of that was that I had done a dual major, composition and viola performance in the last. The last year, my composition teacher said, you know, you need to graduate, better quit performing and write your pieces and get done.
So you played a lot of viola.
So that I did.
So what, just for fun, what are some of the cool things about working in that orchestra? Like, were there perks? Did you get to hang with the prophet every once in a while? Did you feel special? Were there little special things they do? Like, tell us some of the fun or cool things about working in that job.
One of the fun things was just the celebrities that you got to perform with. Like one of the last performances that we did with them was with the Oak Ridge Boys.
Right.
It was just a real kick to get to be on the stage with the Oak Ridge Boys or like all the Christmas specials like Angela Lansbury and Walter Cronkite and just all these famous people that...
Megan Follows sticks out in my mind for some reason.
Oh, yeah, that was the first year. Anna Green Gables. Megan right. Follows. And
I'm a big fan, I guess.
But. Yeah, Frederico von Stade. So it was really exciting to get to perform with these incredible, incredible performers. That was a huge perk right there. And then once in a while you would every year they would have a Christmas party with the choir and orchestra and their spouses. And President Hinckley would always come to the Christmas party and speak. And that was always a really special moment. So, and sometimes there'd be a general authority at a broadcast or something who might say something. So,
yeah, well, and on a more serious note, I mean, my sense of spirituality as a musician was always very, very tied to music. And so the opportunity, really, I think for me in some ways, this was a really good thing because I hadn't been able to pursue the path I had wanted to with spirituality in becoming a teacher, but I still had this calling to share the gospel in a way that I was hopefully uniquely qualified for, which was through music. And it was exciting, and I was carrying on the family tradition because Dad had been in the Tabernacle Choir. It's kind of, people are always, ooh, you're in the orchestra.
People say, I saw you on TV. Yeah, that was kind of fun.
There are fun things. And then for me, a lot of my profoundly spiritual moments during those years were when I was performing. Because we got to play the best arrangements of the hymns, and it was wonderful. It was a lot of work too, especially because we were married and we had kids, and so we both had to go to rehearsals and find. We pretty much we're just now in the last few years learning how to date as a married couple, because our dates were to go sit across the orchestra from each other for years. Right. That was our dating. So.
Yeah, I'm not even a musician, and I love our hymns and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir so much. I just think of that being as like the pinnacle. You're getting to play music, which you love, for the most notable choir in the world, for the one true church, and all of its members and the rest of the world to hear. I mean,
yeah, he summed it up. Exactly.
You said it better than me.
Is that how it felt to do it?
Yeah, it was. Did
the luster wear off and it got, you know, to be a drag?
Well, there were things that happened, like politics, that I saw that took some of the luster away from it. Things that were just not specifically to me, but to other members of the orchestra, and that were just really not, in my mind, in keeping with the gospel, and that took some of the fun out of it.
I want to ask about that because I actually got an inquiry from a listener, a question to ask you guys. But let me just ask: those politics type stuff, did they happen after Peter, you wrote the letter, or before you wrote the letter, or
was all long before? In fact, we were really upset for a while about a number of things that have. Boy, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
There were some not nice things that happened. But on the other hand, you know, we finally were disturbed enough that we went and talked to them about it and said, this disturbs us. And they helped resolve some of our concerns. Not all of them, obviously, because some of it was how certain people had been treated. And so we felt like, well, okay, we were listened to and our concerns were respected, and they were pretty nice about it and took some steps to fix what we were worried about. So,
yeah, so we felt pretty good.
So overall, you know, human, political kind of things, but overall a wonderful experience.
Yeah, there was a lot of politics too around what I mentioned before, that initially when they had started it, it was with the idea that we'll hire the musicians from the orchestra for paid gigs, and there was clearly some resistance from above to that idea, and some kind of backhanded things happened there that were really unfortunate, and then they ended up doing away with it. And they were asking a lot of us. During the Olympics, we were every other night, I think, we had a rehearsal.
Every night except for Monday night, we had something every day during the Olympics for like 4 weeks.
And at that point, they had a be here or be out sort of policy, which they changed after that. When I think they had a lot of complaints.
It kind of came to a head, and a lot of people were really burned out, and they resolved that.
So it could be grueling at times.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, it was a We loved it, and we actually loved it enough to lose money doing it. Because our income at the time, we taught 30 students between us. And then when we could, we took, you know, paid freelance gigs. And then I had a part-time job working for a school. And so to go at night, cut into, we had to cancel students. We had to give up other things to go do this calling.
Yeah. It was worth it though. We really liked
it. It was totally worth it. We wouldn't have done it if it wasn't probably. Mm-hmm.
So, tell me about what would lead you to consider writing the letter that you wrote to the Salt Lake Tribune. Like, give some whatever history you think led up to the point where you'd even consider it.
Well, I wasn't a seminary teacher, which meant that we were trying to make a living at music. And the longer we did that, the more I realized that when our kids are school age, this isn't going to work because we'll both have to work at night. And they'll be in school. And this just really isn't going to work out for our family in some ways, was kind of what I thought. And so I decided to go back to school. I'd always had I had almost majored in psychology for my undergrad degree before I really settled on music. And I decided I wanted to be a therapist. And a friend of ours in the orchestra, I was telling him about this and that, oh, I think maybe I'll try to get into the psychology program, or I've read about this licensed personal counselor program at the University of Phoenix. And he said, why don't you be a social worker? And I said, what's that? He said, well, you could be a therapist. And they have a great program at the U. And so I ran up there, got their information and read it and said, hey, I never heard of this before, but it sounds awesome. The next day, was the deadline for application. So I ran home and wrote my two essays that they wanted and submitted it and miraculously got in the program. And school was a really wonderful experience. It was actually going to school. We started, that's where I talked about studying about dual cultures. And I started to realize that some of my sense of having never fit in had to do with the fact that my identity was largely formed by my father, who, despite the fact that we were Mormon, instilled an incredibly strong sense of Jewish identity in me. And we'd make some attempts to celebrate the holidays. And I kind of grew up thinking I'm Jewish, and you can do that as a Mormon. You can be, you can be more Jewish than the Jews. So I kind of had that sense, but also I was realizing that, maybe the reason everyone always said I was so argumentative was that people didn't explore ideas in the same way. You couldn't say, that doesn't make sense to me, and challenge people on their logic or on their interpretation of things in Mormon culture. That wasn't really the way things happened. And I, cause I'm not, I don't think I'm a terribly argumentative person, but I had all these people like, why do you keep disagreeing with us? And I would think, oh, we were just talking, and it was a nice conversation until you got mad at me. I could never really figure that out. So that was nice. The second thing that happened to me up there, I started exploring that, and then I realized really a few months in, I thought, I'm going to be a therapist, and someday I'm going to sit across from someone, and they're going to say, I think I'm gay. And I thought, what would I do? I know what the gospel teaches about this. And so I'm not sure it would be okay for me not to help them follow the gospel teachings. But then I realized that's not really very fair to them. I don't think I can do, as I thought, I can't have my own crisis when someone comes in and says, I think I'm gay. I can't panic and run out of the room screaming. So I thought, I have to know everything I can about this issue so that I can decide how to work this. Because I really love the social work ethic of you allow the client to go on their own journey. This really spoke to me deeply. And this was an area where I was thinking, maybe I just have to tell them I can't be your therapist unless you want to do this. And then, but that didn't seem right either. Here we've built this rapport and now I'm going to abandon you.
Was there anything about your upbringing that made you sensitive to the plight of the homosexuals?
Honestly, probably not.
So you didn't know anyone, brother or sister?
I had a friend that I knew was gay that didn't talk about it very much.
Right. So just, yeah.
In the music program. Right. That was it.
Okay. Okay. So it really was the master's in social work.
This was really why I was thinking
about it. It got you thinking about it. Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I started reading everything I could, and I happened across a book that happened to be co-edited by a mother of a kid I grew up with, Mary Beth Raines, Peculiar People. So I started reading that, and I read everything I could find, and the more I read, the more disturbed I got, because I realized really quickly people do not choose their sexual orientation. They come with it, most of them. There may be a few people who said something different, but by and large, I was reading the same thing in all these stories, and they really, as I read them, they rang true to me. They made sense, and I had kind of just grown up thinking, you know, people are gay because they want to be, and they're wicked, just what I was taught, really. And when I realized this, I was really horrified, because I thought, I treated these people badly my whole life. And here I was just a few minutes ago thinking, you know, what am I going to say to them when I, a few weeks ago, thinking, what am I going to say to them when they come into counseling? And I'm realizing that I was completely uninformed. I would say the one thing from my upbringing is that I knew really bad things could happen to people in our church. I knew that people could be treated, could be abused, and that they could, and that there was no way around that. There was no way for the victim really to get that solved. And so I think that was probably the one thing that I saw we were making a big mistake. I read about the aversion shock therapy at BYU. I was really disturbed. I remember I came home talking about it a lot and probably bothered Mary, because at some point I finally said, the brethren are wrong about this issue. And I don't know what to do about that. They can't not know this stuff, is what I thought, because it's out there. And surely they must have looked and researched just like I'm doing, because surely they care. And I also knew an incredible amount about church history. I mean, when I talked to people who've left the church over church history concerns, I kind of have to laugh, because I knew most of this stuff long before I ever really questioned anything.
But it never troubled you.
Well, you know, I just didn't really let it bother me too much. I did take Doctrine and Covenants twice, because the first time through in Institute, I had run into a lot of things that really bothered me. And I thought there's got to be, my dad had taught me that religion had to be rational. There had to be a way to think things through. And I had run into all these things that I just couldn't fit into my worldview. And so I'd found another teacher that someone had recommended to me who taught me all the same things, but had helped open the doors to a way of resolving them within the gospel framework. He was an incredible teacher.
What was his name?
Norman.
Put you on the spot.
No, I called him President Norman, because it was Mary's brother's mission president. And I think he's the one that told me, oh, you should take a class from my mission president while you're up there. He was an incredible teacher, you know. So where the first teacher had taught me about Fanny Alger and how Joseph Smith had whispered to her about, you know, why don't we start polygamy here, and told her about the angel telling him he had to start it. This kind of bothered me how it was presented the first time. And he was able to talk about how this was such a burden on Joseph that he was terrified of it. And obviously it was hard to implement. And so I had the best explanations, I think, that were available at my disposal. And some things I just didn't think about very much. Even before it was a big emphasis, I think, in the correlated teachings, I really felt like the atonement, the idea of atonement, was central to everything. And so I always wanted to pull everything back to that. And I think that kept me really centered and away from some of the scary questions. There was, I would think, I'd found ways around enough of them that I thought there's a way around all of them, and if I don't know it yet, it'll come to me. I'll just keep working on it. Thank you.